Hello everyone and welcome to JFG Tonight. For the first time on Odyssey, I'm operating under the same setting as I was on YouTube, with quality rather than zero latency. And that means perhaps my guess, because we had the permission from Thomas yesterday, the CEO of Odyssey, he said, yes, you can use this feature now with the new backend. And so hopefully that means less buffering for you guys, but keep me updated tonight so I can figure out if it's a better setting. Because one of the big problem, the reason Odyssey buffers is that it doesn't stack a very long buffer. So anything that goes wrong in the chain of transmission and Odyssey finds itself having to refresh your video with the content that it's constantly receiving. Normally, the way you protect against this is by having the computer stack a 20 seconds of reserve, so people get the show 20 seconds delayed, but in exchange, they get less buffering. So Lapitop says, seems fine so far. Excellent. We'll see how it goes. How are you doing, people of the regular chat? Some random bloke says, hi, JF from Australia. So today I'm starting a two-video series where I will give my first thoughts on Frank Salter, because I'm now more than 70% of the through the book, and so I'm equipped to start reviewing it, but I think it's going to take two nights, and anyways, I'm not finished. However, I've developed my opinion on this whole question of kin selection and how much we should extend it. Because kin selection starts with the realization that you share genetic similarity with your siblings, your cousins, your parents. And so from a genetic, just selfish gene perspective, the genes that favor altruistic behavior and to a certain extent self-sacrificial behavior toward your kin can survive. Now, they can survive, that's one thing. And the idea of Frank Salter has always been to extend this to large families, ethnies, tribes, the nation, or whatever is the level of analysis you want to put it at. We could see our genetic interests lying in not only our close family and our children, but in the rest of society, and how much the rest of society also carries statistically a certain percentage of our genes. I've always been uncomfortable with kin selection in all of the context in which it is invoked, because I think it is overly invoked. I'm not sure it's a mechanistic explanation in many cases. And I also think that there often lacks a review of the alternative, a review of the possibility that, hey, what about the possibility that altruism isn't evolved from kin selection, and what could be the alternative scenarios? Whenever we talk of kin selection, we end up with a specific human behavior that often is very rare. People will invoke something like a kamikaze, driver of a plane, just self-sacrificing for the success of his nation. That is the kind of things that seems to be hard to explain from a selfish genetic perspective. But I look at this behavior and first I note how rare it is. I don't see people self-sacrificing for their nations. Even the people who work in the army and who could die from engaging in war, I see them first. I see a portion of their war activities benefit their families. I see men being used mostly because they inseminate their wife and they go to the front. And I see their genetic continuity still being there. So do we really need kin selection to explain how a man goes to defend his nation? Perhaps he's defending his family. I also note that one of the big weaknesses of kin selection is that as if you try to apply it to the current standard of modern humans and the size of our societies, you're stuck with the problem that we're probably in uncharted territory in terms of the size of the nations that we are forming. The genes were probably never confronted in an environment where a single political decision could be taken for the whole of Europe. That is a big overarching system of political control we have, and I think the genes have never seen this. And so if you want to start theoretizing around I don't know, an English person favoring a French person over an African, you have to realize that the ancestors that have led to the existence of the current English and French person, who may have at some point have been assembled under Europe, these ancestors didn't live enough situations in which they had a choice to make between French or African. And it's very hard for me to see how a single kin selection ethnic behavior of the modern world could be explained by kin selection from an ancestral standpoint, because I think the ensemble of groups that we form today is uncharted territory for genes, which is why precisely our genes have so much difficulty at handling it. Consider, for example, how political institutions today are controlled by women, because women have the right to vote and they are more numerous in the population. They are demographically overrepresented because our society kills males more often and quicker than women. Now, the ensemble of the phenotype of women has never been offered the right to vote before a few decades ago in our entire evolutionary history. And they've had extremely low control over intertribe politics and stuff of that kind. So, all of this to say, women today have a control over our immigration policies, and it's not because they are extending their kin perceptions to the outside world, including African migrants. It is because they have just never seen that evolutionary history, and they have never evolved to make political decisions. This is what I mean by uncharted territory. They have not been punished yet by evolution for their bad decisions. And so much of the modern decisions that happen in current society will not be explainable by kin selection or by, in fact, any evolutionary history. It will be explained by an absence of evolutionary history. The reason Europe is so open at threatening its own demographic stability with its own policies is in large part because it's our evolutionary blind spot. There never was a time for our ancestor to evolve those psychological predispositions that would lead us to reject migrants and to perceive a danger in our migration policy. John Drake says that punishment is on its way. Yes. And then the question is, suppose that the unfoldings of the events in the next 200 years lead to a complete demographic disappearance of, say, the white race in Europe. And so women have been punished for their bad political skills. Okay, but then what? Was that an event of kin selection? See? Was that an event of kin selection? Do we need on genetic interest to understand this event if it was to happen? And we're not even getting into the mess of what did happen, because this is filled with problems of empiricism, and we don't really know what happened in our evolutionary story, and we cannot go back in the past. But even with this theoretical example, in the future, I have difficulty saying for sure if the entirety of Europe was replaced by African migrants. I have difficulty knowing for sure if I need a kin selection, kind of pro-African, kind of ethnic preference within the invading migrants to explain how it happened. Because let us not forget that ultimately the political system that has led to immigration could be seen as part of the phenotype, and it really doesn't matter that this phenotype takes the form of a fully calculated democracy. It's a phenotype, and ultimately the woman who would have voted for pro-migration policies would have been punished at their selfish genetic level. So do I really need an ethnic theory to understand how a full replacement of a population would happen? I'm not sure I do. And still, after reading most of Frank Salter's book on genetic interest, family, ethnicity, and humanity in an age of mass migration, I'm still not sure I need that. Stephen J. James has sent a super chat. By the way, if you'd like to support the show, do like Stephen J. James. Use the dollar button under the regular chat. Odyssey is my favorite platform for super chats. Alternatively, feel free to use Entropy. The link is in the description below. It is a good platform to send me free questions as well as super chats. Stephen J. James was saying, before the railroad, an occasional disruption by war, was everybody in Europe pretty much fucking their third slash fourth slash fifth cousins for thousands of years? JF? Well, it's not as easy as this. There, you say before the railroad, an occasional disruption by war. The history of Europe is a constant history of war. And within tribe war, across tribe war, outside replacement by invading colonialists, it's not like this was, I wouldn't call it an occasional disruption by war. And there is no such thing as everybody in Europe. It's every saying everybody is in Europe is like looking at a bottle of water and saying every single molecule in this bottle. You won't be able to characterize their movements. For example, some molecules are going that way, some molecules are going that way. And some people were in Europe and they were seeing waves of attackers, and sometimes the attackers were succeeding, and even when they were succeeding, they were only replacing 70-80% of the population. There were always people who had the genetic constitution or the chance to be at the right place to not be eliminated by the waves of invaders, and they were surviving and they were pooling their genes with the new arrivals. And so there is, and you say before the railroad, well, there's been progress in transportations before the railroad that was also creating waves of incoming invaders and migrants. And ultimately, even if you are a descendant of Europe, if you are fully European genetically, you probably come from one of these waves of attackers, most likely, because these waves of attackers have been completely unleashed onto Europe and have succeeded at taking over. So there were Europeans before the European that you became. And were they fucking their third, fourth, or fifth cousin? Not so far, yes, they were. I mean, you can almost extrapolate this from the very fact that genetic disorders become meaningless or much rarer in terms of recessive issues when you get to fourth, fifth cousin. Why is that? Well, it's because we have evolved to fuck our fourth or fifth cousin, basically. You can see it that way. It's there's a little non sequitur in there. It's a little bit extrapolated, and I wouldn't state it as certainty, but it's a good measure. You know, the same way you see the age at which people are capable of reproducing, you can say roughly, well, that means that our ancestors were having babies at this age. The same way you can say, since the fourth or fifth cousin is the boundary after which you can reproduce without health problems, then it's likely that we roughly evolve to fuck in that range. Skady Warrior says, politics, also fewer women than men actually vote. You also do not take into account society being divided along class lines, still very strong in the UK. Very weak position from someone educated. And I guess that was the follow-up to a previous chat. He was saying, we might get further if blame for everything wasn't laid at the door of women. So juvenile. The world is now and has always been run by men. Have a look at who dominates the WEF, who is playing games over whose group will take the world into the next century, while women lie buried under the rubble. This guy. Okay. Result of presidential election, if only men voted. So, I want you to look at this. I want you to look at this map. Projected results for the 2018 midterms based on polling patterns. What if only men voted? 249 Republicans, 186 Democrats. You're not going to bullshit me that America is controlled by men. America is under democratic control because women have the right to vote, period. If women didn't have the right to vote, there would be no Democrat progressives in power. There might have been zero success for any Democrats running. So no, don't bullshit me on this. And as far as the women stuck under the rubble, the women are stuck under the rubble in Ukraine because they don't have to go to war. They're stuck under the rubble because their husbands are stuck in front of the incoming bullets. So you are taking an instant, and this is exactly the problem with the perception of women as the eternal victims in our society, and you totally play in that crap. Women are not under the rubble because they are being victimized by the decisions of male. Women are under the rubble because they are a privileged caste of society that doesn't even have to fight for their existence because they have puppets to do that, and the puppets are men, okay? Women are under the rubble because men don't have the choice to be under the rubble. Men have to be on top of the rubble, receiving bullets and rockets and artillery from the Russians. So don't you come here and bullshit me on, oh my God, the world is controlled by men. It is not. The world is built to ensure that the deprived class that men are continued to be viewed as disposable muscle masses to be sent toward the cannons as they come. Let's get started. Anyways, I've been brought on a parallel point of discussion here. That was not the interesting thing here. I was bringing the question of females voting just to show the novelty of the current world. And if you want to have a theory of kin selection matters, and even ethnic selection matters, you should never forget that the world in the way it looks like right now is a totally novel thing. The world has never known 50-50 female-controlled democracy, okay? So our genes cannot have been prepared for what's happening. So you could see in our political decisions things that would inspire you to believe that we've been selected to care about ethnicity or not care about it enough, and you'd be wrong in both cases. We have simply not evolved to handle decision-making the way we're currently running it. Ariel Suarez sends a super chat. Thank you so much for supporting the show. He says, women are under the rubble because it's safer to be under the rubble. Exactly. I mean, it's one of these, and they do this, leftists do this with women, minorities. They take an aspect of their life that is actually a privilege, and they try to pass it to you as if it's a sign that they are being discriminated against. The one person that's being discriminated against right now in Ukraine is the man who is being forced by law to join a war that he may not believe in, when in fact the women are not forced by law to do so. If that's discrimination 101, there's nothing that fits the description of discrimination more than this, and it's happening against males. All right, so let's get started on Frank Salter. He has a new edition of the book in which he quickly summarizes in his preface the argument that he wants to make. So I think it's the best illustration of the argument he wants to make. Now, there are parts of this argument which are moral, and there are parts of this argument which are factual, and it's important to keep both separate. Because in the end, I agree with the conclusion of Frank Salter. We should care about ethnicity. We should care about demographics. We should feel invested in the outcome of our society as it relates to how much the people around us resemble us. But there is a point of technical detail. I'm not sure we should care about it for the sake of it. And I'm not sure we should care about it to the expense of our individual interest. Because we've had on this show, and this is where Frank Salter is totally right up my alley in terms of what he talks about, because across the years, again and again, I've been facing with people on the chat and people calling on the show saying, JF, like very recently, we had one who had a perfect Asian girlfriend. But it was like, but I'm not going to make babies with her. I'm going to drop her because I want to protect the white race. That is an example to me of kin selection went wrong. Where your desire to save the race is driving you towards self-destructive behavior, and in fact, potentially race-destructive behavior, because there's no evidence that the guy who called us to say this will have a European girlfriend next week. So, two things that I challenge. One, the factual question of did kin selection at this level of ethnicity happen regularly enough in our evolutionary history that it ended up mattering to who we became? That's the factual part. The second part is, should we care for the demographic stability of our nations for the sake of it? Should we define it as a goal of our life to have our kin representation extended into the rest of society? Or should we see it more as a tool? I tend to see it more as a tool for my selfish genetic interest. I understand that the kind of guy I am does not survive well in Central Africa. And I understand that The kind of guy that I am participates to productive nations when surrounded by similar people to the guy that I am. And so I see the alignment is very well ordered between my personal selfish genetic interest and my race interest. I'm totally advantaged personally if I'm surrounded by people of my race, and I am much less advantaged, and I'm much less purposeful in a world that differs from it in a world either that is a African anarchy of some kind or a or an Asian authoritarian country. Those are countries in which my genes wouldn't be very successful. So it may sound like it's a very specific and small objection, but I think it's an objection that is not truly addressed in Frank Salter, at least in this book that I read up to now. And it's an important one. Ariel Suarez says, leftists also cherry pick a lot, focusing on very minor issues, while the group they consider privileged go through much greater issues, although it could be the same you referred to, JF. Yes, and our person that I was responding to, I believe, has replied, you are missing the point I was making. Stop women voting and what? All will be right in the world. Life will be completely different. There are no stupid men, right? It's not quite so simple as that. But you're fighting strawmen, because I never said these things. I never said there are no stupid men. So, as far as if we were to stop women voting, would this solve problems? As Firestarter points out, it's an empirical question. I don't know. Would having 249 Republican districts in 2018 solve some problem? Maybe some. All right, so let's get started on the summary of Frank Salter on genetic interest. He says, to quickly summarize the role of evolutionary theory on genetic interest, I show the following syllogism. One, so there's 5 points. One, evolutionary theory premise. Neo-Darwinian theory explains how nepotism evolved as the means for spreading the genes coding for that trait. In their evolutionary environments, species that evolved kin altruism obeyed Hamilton's rule for adaptive altruism, directing helping behavior preferentially towards genetic kin who share substantial proportion of each other's genes. So that's already the factual point, and a factual point with which I take some issue. I'm not sure that the neo-Darwinian theory of kin altruism applied at the level of ethnies explains our differential treatment of various races or our different attitudes toward various races. And I made that point to Edward Dutton when he came on this show. Here's an alternative hypothesis, and I really don't see any facts that tell me my alternative hypothesis is less good than this. An alternative hypothesis goes as follows. The white population and black population, say, or Asian, have lived apart from each other for so long that the behavioral repertoire of people in these races have not truly evolved to respond to each other. In fact, your genes have not evolved to respond to Asian or black people. Your ancestors have not been exposed to enough Asian or black people to even have had the time to get this evolution going. Instead, what happened is that there was a series of genetic drifts that led to the European, and also natural selection pressure, that led the European phenotype to look very different from the African and Asian phenotypes. These differences have built up across generations, and eventually everything that tunes your conception of who's a human, who should I interact with, who's dangerous, all of it has been shifted toward, if you were in Europe, toward seeing the European as the default. That's how a man looks, that's how a woman looks. And in fact, even our selection, our sexual selection capabilities have been fine-tuned by this evolutionary history away from Africans and Asians, so that our taste for females, for example, have adapted to the European female, while in Africa, their taste for their females was adapted to the looks of an African female. As a result, in the modern world, we suddenly have a clash of people with different phenotypes living together, living close enough that if you're in a big town in America, you can see people of other races, Asians, blacks, etc. Because of this novel proximity, your phenotype is perceiving someone that is different from those you have evolved to interact with, and therefore deploys a series of differential behavior. But these differential behaviors have not evolved for you to handle relationships with Africans. They are just a byproduct of a fine-tuning that has happened to lead to your preference for European people and to lead to their preference for African people. Now, this explanation would explain why you have racial delay when you click on pictures and they try to mess with your mind with pictures of different people from different race. It could explain racial preference, sexual preference for your own race, could explain all of it without a single event of kin selection happening. Because for kin selection to have happened, it would be the case that okay, your genes have deployed responses to Europeans. Eventually, your genes were confronted with so many Africans and they were behaving differently. And eventually, your genes learned to tell the difference between Europeans and Africans. And on top of it, your genes must have found a phenotypic strategy such that the behavior deployed specifically toward European or toward Africans would lead to a higher proportion of European in the world and a lower proportion of Africans in the world. All of this from individual human behavior deployed by genes that would have been selected to favor your ethnicity. I think my explanation is easier. I think my mechanism is easier to say, much of the way we interact with other races is actually an accidental product rather than an evolved product. Do You Want Lunch says ethnies. I mean, that's how he calls it in the book. An ethny would be a group defined with some border, like all of the Europeans or all of the English. That's what we mean here by ethny. Whatever cluster of genetic differentiation between a subset of people. So I don't want to say that kin selection is impossible. I think it's possible in principle, and I think it's certainly possible between brothers and sisters. However, just how complex would a behavior have to be, and just how much contact between two races would you have needed to have for these genes to have a meaningful representation today? Genes that would somehow make you favor your own race. And I think that most of the favoring that we do of our own race is an accidental product. You know, when we work together, when we cooperate, when we build the societies as we know them right now, I don't think it's done for the preservation of the race, because I don't think that our ancestors had different evolutionary choice. I don't think they had the choice to build great cities for Africans. It never happened. So if we build great cities and they happen to benefit our race, I don't think it's necessary to have a kin selection explanation for it. I think we could simply root our tendency to cooperate to the building of cities, for example, to self-interest. We are building these cities. They turn out to help our ethnicity, but it's an accidental product of the pursuit of our own interest. Because in the end, there is no way to help our ethnicity other than helping ourselves in the first place. And whatever you build that will benefit your ethnic will most likely benefit you. And you first, in fact, because most of what we build is private. It's for our own disposal and use. Grapes Coda says, Jeff, why is xenophobia more common than xenophilia? Why has anti-immigrant sentiment been the majority view for over 50 years in the UK? Well, I've explained why I think it could be. I think it could simply be that our genes have evolved without much contact with other races. And so they have evolved to detect the features of a reciprocating individual, and it happens that they have identified more and more, okay, whenever you see a guy with a white face, he's going to reciprocate, he's going to collaborate. Most of the time, you know, he's not going to be there to attack you. Most of the time, your interactions with him will be productive and, in fact, good for yourself. So just this mechanism and just an absence of contact with other races could be sufficiently a justification for any kind of racial preference emerging. And there's a difference. If our racial preferences have evolved, it's different than if they just happen to be that way due to other mechanism. Maybe it's not a difference that matters that much for the moral and political questions around it, but from an evolutionary theory perspective, I wouldn't want to commit to a kin ethnic explanation if the other explanations have not been excluded and they still make sense. So that was number one, the evolutionary theory premise. I have a reservation on the declaration here. Number two, motivational premise. Assume a fitness preserver who cares about his or her genetic interest. This caring might take the practical form of being nurturant towards genetic kin in family or ethnic. With growing knowledge, it might even become partly abstracted as a desire for adaptiveness in the neo-Darwinian sense of genetic continuity. So not much is said here in this premise because he's asking you in the first place to assume a fitness preserver. Okay, but there's one thing I want to highlight here. There's a problem with kin selection and there's an asymmetry in it. The asymmetry is as follows. So what kin selection is telling us is you have two ways of perpetuating your genes in the next generation. One is replication, so making babies. And two is helping babies that already exist survive better or reproduce better and making sure that these babies are close genetically to you. And this will increase their representation in the next generation. Here's the asymmetry. For the kin selection to exist, you need someone to have made a baby. So for the second mechanism to operate in any meaningful way, you need someone to have gone through the first mechanism. And this asymmetry, I would almost represent it as a form of parasitism. Very often we talk of homosexuality and heterosexuality, and we point out, rightfully so, that basically homosexuality has to pass through... They cannot raise their own babies, basically. They have to convince, if you want to term it that way, they have to convince people to constantly convert toward homosexuality. And if you convert toward homosexuality, you're much less likely to have babies. And if you do, you are ultimately hetero. So you've kind of defeated your own definition as an homosexual. And we point to this asymmetry, and it ends up mattering to families. Because imagine that you're a heterosexual couple. You have a child. Let's say that it's your only child. they become homosexual, that's the end of your line of descent. And not only this, but the entirety of their lives not only is basically a fight against heterosexuality, but it depends on heterosexuality. They wouldn't have existed if it wasn't of heterosexuality. And you can see that ultimately there's a form of exploitation that homosexuals, they get to experience the full feeling of existence with its pleasures and pains and the full experience of existing, but they do so without creating existence of their own. They do so without having babies. They do so without passing the torch on. A gene that would be purely operating through kin selection strategies would be a little bit like the gay gene. It would need someone else to pass the torch of existence. In the same way, homosexuals not making their own babies cannot pass on homosexuality to their own children, kin selectionists don't make their own babies. They have to pass through the babies made by their brothers and their sisters. And there's a fundamental exploitative position there. I know that Frank Salter's point is that the mathematics are equal. Whether you save 8 cousins, because the whole idea is saying if you die but you save 8 of your cousins or 4 of your brothers and sisters, you have increased your genetic representation in the next generation. Mathematically, it's true. However, in life, it matters by which mechanism you pass through, because there's a difference between making a baby and delegating the task of making a baby. Delegating the task of making a baby is a security risk. If we were to analyze it from a computer security perspective, that would be a bug, because it's exploitable. The strategy of making babies is always the surest one. It's the one where you can be sure that you have everything you need to continue existence and you pass on the torch of existence to a new generation. If your input in the world is merely, oh, I'm going to let my brothers and sisters have babies and I'm going to help them, you have certain problems. First, you have a problem in a generation where you don't have brothers and sisters. And the same would be true at the ethnic level. If you don't have all that it takes to make babies, and you find yourself at some point, the events of civilization are such that you find yourself isolated, and all you've evolved for is help your ethnic, but there's no more ethnic around you. There's no more ethnic around you, and you've specialized in a direction of the evolutionary system that suddenly is not useful anymore. This is the end of your line of descent. And so I think that we should always veneer, is the word veneer? We should always venerate or admire and make sacred. We should always see as sacred the activity of making babies, the reproductive activities, as being central to life. In fact, I would argue to Frank Salter that you are as much the DNA replicas as you are any of your genes. You are as much the protein that ensures that there's a replication activity happening every generation as you are the full informational content of your genes. Because here's the thing, and that's one thing I show in The Revolutionary Phenotype. And by the way, I'm not a phenotypic argumenter. I'm not telling you that you are your culture, you are your feeling, you are your brain. None of this. But there's one thing about life that actually supersedes the content of your genes in terms of letters of DNA. And it's this cycle of replication. Because your ancestors were replicators before they even had DNA. That's something to weigh when you think about kin selection and redirecting some of the human attention toward kin selection. Never forget that there was a cycle of replication happening in RNA before there was one with DNA. And your existence absolutely relies on this past in this cycle of RNA self-replicator. And at that time, there was zero letters of your genetic code that was DNA. Eventually, DNA showed up. And so you can do mathematics of DNA relatedness, but never forget that the thing that starts it all is a cycle of phenotypic to gene, phenotypic to gene, phenotypic to gene. Phenotype to gene, phenotype to gene, phenotype to gene. And you are as much the printer that made these mutational errors as you are these mutational errors. You know, physically, the printer of DNA, the replicas and the other molecules involved in error checking mechanism, they are you also. And they actually made all of the informational errors that eventually would end up in you getting naturally selected. When you give up reproduction, and I'm not saying that Frank Salter advocates for giving up reproduction, but he's treading in waters that are extremely dangerous. Because if you start caring so much about your race that you are self-abnegating, that you forget the importance of self-replication as a central component of life, eventually your race will become something else. And your altruism will be redirected toward the wrong thing and will be directed away from you existing at all eventually. It's a little bit like when you send people camping. And some people who are not used to camping, they will want to bring all sorts of luxuries, but they will forget the fundamental. They will want to bring superb food, but they don't realize that if you're camping, there are certain things that you won't be able to cook. It's going to be different. You have to be more essential. You have to go back to your survival package and the minimal. Well, I strongly object to any conceptions of kin, ethnic interest that would in any way supersede or combat or be seen as preferential to reproduction, precisely because reproduction is existential. There's no way you can be a good kin-selected ethnic if you don't have people within that ethnic making the actual freaking babies. And you might as well include this in your survival camping kit because it's a necessary thing for life. Tillman says, JF, the stream is really smooth tonight, no buffering. Wonderful, I'm happy about it. Has it already been 1 hour? Well, it's true, we started 10 minutes late. But my God, I've just been sharing my thoughts on the first two paragraphs, and I have so much to do. I'll keep doing it, but I need a break. So I'll be back. I'll be back in 10 seconds to continue the three other points. All right, people are saying I should have a promo video for my breaks. Yes, I should. I should have a TRP shock video that comes in, you know. That would be hilarious. Like, for Christmas, give the gift of survival to your children. And then a nuclear bomb just... That would be awesome. I totally see it. I'll be working on this and trying to make it happen. Grapes Coda says, if you're not surrounded by people selected for a similar environment, then you don't have any appropriate partners anyway. This is already the end of your ethnic and by proxy, you. Yeah, this is what I would have liked to see. Can't we have an argument for ethnic consideration that is rooted in self-interest? And I've read 70% of the book up to now, and let me tell you, I don't find a single case that is put before us that wouldn't be explained alternatively by this outlook. This outlook that, yeah, I'm invested in having similar people around myself. But that's because similar people leads to so much advantages. First, genetic compatibility, behavioral compatibility, a relative kind of equality before the state such that you don't end up having radically different interests in the kind of government you want and the kind of government I want. So less war, less conflict, less asymmetry. There's a big problem in a country where you have two races who are distinct and different enough that one ends up having interest in draining the energy of the other. But all of this could be rooted in self-interest. Ultimately, you may not participate to maintaining your society demographically stable because of it. You may just be interested in keeping it demographically stable because you have interest in surviving yourself. So number three, strategic conclusion. Then the individual from premise two, and that was the perfect fitness preserver that was assumed, should pursue certain strategies such as those described in premise one and others, depending on circumstances. So I don't disagree with this particular point. If you invoke a fitness preserver, a theoretical fitness preserver, then there are certain ways that he should act to maximize that kind of fitness, which you've defined him as caring about. Number four, moral premises. Morality is one set of human values that constrains behavior. Ethical issues arise when interests conflict, as they inevitably do in fitness competition. Universal features of morality include duty to aid kin, as well as reciprocity. So that is a tough one for me. I don't think you have a duty to aid kin. I think in most circumstances, in 99.9% of the cases, helping kin, helping your ethnic, will be favorable, will be very low cost to you. Like saving someone, for example, saving someone from a troublesome situation, but not one in which you put yourself at major risk. Just one where you just extend a helping hand with someone in need. Most of the cases you can do it without hurting yourself. You can do it at low risk to yourself. And in those cases where there are risks, then you'll have less and less good Samaritans doing that kind of move. And then you're going to start having people paid to do that job. For example, army, police, rescuers of all kind. So they still run some risk, but first, because they're professionals, they're reducing the risk to a minimum. And second, they are compensated for the risk. So a policeman who dies on duty will be able to ensure that his wife and his family will continue existing and will do so with life insurance and other other grants by the people who were employing him. So in all of these cases, I don't see a fundamental duty to the ethnic or to even the kin. What I see is there are ways to compensate for certain risks that people take for the group, and the market for such workers is subject to a cost-benefit analysis for each of the individual worker according to ultimately their genetic, selfish genetic interest. I don't see in our society sacrifice for the kin. I see people sometimes making up as people who have been, especially in my circles, you know, as a YouTuber, I've been talking about demographics and ethnic. And it has led to some audience members to be completely obsessed with the preservation of the race to the cost of their own life and their own reproduction. But those are cognitive constructs. I don't think that in our society we have common enough behavior of full self-sacrificial devotion without compensation that is needed to explain, that needs kin selection as an explanation. 5, ethical conclusion. Moral actors will defend their own genetic continuity, not maximize fitness at others' expense, according to the principle of adaptive utilitarianism. One practical implication is universal nationalism. An evolutionary ethic for a crowded world is go forth and perpetuate. So moral actors will defend their own genetic continuity, not maximize fitness at others' expense, according to the principle of adaptive utilitarianism. I mean, he describes a balance here. He describes the idea that there will be a way to maximize fitness, that there will be a way to make the world such that adaptiveness is maximized. Since it's the last, it's among the last chapter that he makes this argument, I will reserve my judgment for this fifth point because it's a part of the book that I haven't read yet. So we'll see what I have to say when I've seen the full argument. So, going into the first 4 chapters. Altmedia 96 says, how much for you to shill my channel? Nationalist.org. Well, you don't really have to pay me much for me to shill your channel. You just have to send me a super chat like you did, and I'll be happy to... I'll be happy to visit your website. The future belongs to those with the longest memory, Friedrich Nietzsche. Okay, let's show. Nationalism remains, after 2 centuries, the most vital political emotion in the world, far more vital than social ideologies such as communism or fascism or even democracy. So that's his website, nationalist.org. If you guys want to check it out, check it out. I don't know what it is. I'll be reading it. And there's descriptions of the flows of immigration happening in Europe historically. All right, very interesting. So going into the chapter 1 to 4. Frank Salter first lays out the structure of how do we calculate genetic interest. And we should be careful here. Genetic interest is an abstract conception. It doesn't really play out in the physical world because at any point, any organism may not be even able to estimate their genetic interest. In fact, as far as we know, humans are the only ones with enough omniscient control over the environment that you could tell exactly what your genetic interests are, because you, I mean, we still don't have full genome of everyone, but imagine a situation in which you have either full genome of everyone or you have a sampling of the environment that's enough to do a very good count of how many genes are there in Europe, how many people have these genes, how likely they are to have each of the gene combinations, such that you could estimate basically with very high precision what is your genetic interest in, say, Europe doubling its population or Africa doubling its population. So for this, you need a conception of, I am different from the other people around me. Okay. What, I am different from a random European. Okay. But I'm also different from a random planet Earth human. So I'm that different from a random planet Earth human, but I'm that different from a random European. And I'm that different from a brother. And I'm, you know, so you have to have a conception of the quantification of the difference between you and someone else. So those are pairwise comparisons. And then another concept that he works on, which is if you want to calculate the change in genetic fitness across generations, you need to know what kind of percentage you represent from a given group or from the whole of planet Earth, and then you need to calculate the differential. So imagine, for example, that you are that there's only 30 people existing in the world. You're one of these 30 people. Let's say that these 30 people are Europeans. Okay, so you'll be different from each of these 30 Europeans by X amount of DNA letters. Now imagine that without you making any baby, that suddenly all other people around you make babies and they all end up with a village of 120 people, four times growth of the total population. And you've not made babies. Well, you are now suddenly four times less. This is an event that has reduced your fitness. Even if you have made nothing, the world around you has made something. The population has grown. So there are considerations here which I'm kind of not set on whether Frank Salter's consideration are the only way we can do it. Because what are we evolving for in kin ethnic selection? Are we evolving to be a bigger relative representation of the overall population? Or are we evolving to increase our absolute numbers? I don't think it's either of those responses is true. I think both can be true at different times and in different modes of evolution. If you are caring about your relative representation to a total population, you're really working with assumptions of the kind, well, everyone is replaceable, you know. If suddenly if you make two babies in a very small village, or you make two babies in a very big nation, from the absolute standpoint, you have perpetuated your genes equally successfully. But from the relative standpoint, you have a big failure if you're in too big of a village. If you're in a society where people on average make six babies and you only make two, suddenly, from a relative standpoint, your accomplishments seem to pale in comparison to how in absolute framing they were kind of successful, they were working. And I'm thinking, when is the relative view appropriate and when is the absolute view appropriate? I think that one example of a circumstance in which the absolute view is appropriate is, suppose that you are a special line of descent that is not replaceable by the others. In other words, the thousands of humans around you reproducing couldn't occupy your space in the niche of humanity. Suppose that you're a line of genius, pianists, and creative thinkers and scientists. And suppose that that line is irreplaceable. Basically, if people end up killing your line of descent, they will deprive themselves of good science. If they compete with you, they will fail because they're not as good scientists as you guys are. That would be an example where perhaps the absolute view counts more than the relative view. Because ultimately, the fact that there's 10,000 people around you, but they're very low IQ, they're competing among each other for the low IQ niche of humanity. Perhaps from a perspective of a high IQ niche that is kind of guaranteed across generations, you could forego the relative view that Frank Salter pushes forward, and you could see a more absolutist view where having two babies in that niche is enough because you're still 100% the exploiters of that niche. You're still the only high IQ people around town. And I'm saying two, but think of the same thing if it was four or 100. The point is your relative representation in the population only matters if that population is highly fungible. That's a term from economics, but that I would like to introduce here in the evolutionary system. Because you can very well see if you isolate yourself from a niche perspective that the presence of further and further further numbers of people around you will basically not affect your capacity to perpetuate yourself into the future. If anything, there may be points in humanity at which your chances of survival and perpetuation are bigger, while your mathematical fitness, as it is calculated by Frank Salter, is lower. And one example would be, suppose a bunch of low IQ people around you start competing with one another. Suppose that the low IQ niche on Earth can only be filled by 1 million people, and they're suddenly they make 2 million or 3 million babies. That may be an event in which you are barely affected, and they may never go after you if you're exploiting another niche of humanity. And so that may be an event in which the relative standpoint is not the right one to look at. And I don't see any comment in this book on alternative frameworks rather than this one he proposes. He writes in chapter one, justifying the structure that he will use to mean genetic interest in their calculation. He says, the same applies to ersatz humans. If robots could be made that imitated our children perfectly in outward appearance and behavior, I doubt that many parents would be willing to make the substitution, even if their real children were to go to loving foster homes and robot children were cute and healthy, were toilet trained and winners at school. I have never come across a parent willing to substitute a child, even for another human child. Why? The objection is emotional, based on the bond that has developed between parent and child. And this bond serves genetic interest, the preservation of the parent's distinctive genes. So I want to be clear, this passage I fully agree with, and it's very good as a book to take the normie by the hand and show them how ultimately your reactions. You talk about the bond that you feel with your children, but ultimately you are attached to the genes of your children. It matters to you. I could give you an exact copy of your child. It would be similar in every way, except that he wouldn't have your genes, and to you, that would be less of your child, right? So I think it's a very good book, and I don't want you to mistake the fact that I'm bringing some critiques, because I'm curious. I'm curious about what Frank Salter would respond to this, but in general, I agree with him that we should start making people sensible to the idea that ethnicity matters. He says, Richard Alexander expresses this well. Humans, like other organisms, are so evolved that their interests are reproductive. Said differently, the interests of an individual human, i.e., the directions of its thriving, are expected to be toward ensuring the indefinite survival of its genes and their copies, whether these are resident in the individual, its descendants, or its collateral relatives. And he goes on to say, Frank Salter, from an evolutionary perspective, based on observation of many species, genetic continuity is the ultimate interest of all life, since it has priority over other interests. People are prone to risk their lives for close relatives in emergencies, testament to the power that inclusive fitness has to shape human action. Valuing of proximate interests such as self-preservation evolved to the extent that they enhanced the ultimate reproductive interest. Edward O. Wilson puts proximate interest in neo-Darwinian perspective thus, and he goes on to quote Edward O. Wilson. This is often said in discussion of kin selection, but I rarely see it being proven. Do people really self-sacrifice for loved ones? I mean, males can sacrifice for a female that they've already impregnated, sure. That would make sense without kin selection. I mean, it would make sense from a I'm sacrificing myself for the future children. Not for my relatedness to the future children, but for the fact that even from the perspective of my own life, keeping the future children alive is more efficient because I'm getting old. I'm going to die anyway. I'm not sure that a kin selection hypothesis is needed for explaining much of the human behavior in terms of saving people, because I think that in most cases, saving people comes at a very low risk and very low cost. And those rare cases where it comes at a cost, I don't think it's that often that they happen, that they would need even an evolutionary explanation at all. Alexander believes that genetic interest exists independently of whether they are perceived. We need not be concerned with the possible argument that interests are only definable in terms of what people consciously believe are their interests or intentions. Biologists continually investigate the life interest of non-human organisms while lacking knowledge on this point, and non-human organisms live out their lives serving their interests without knowing in the human sense what those interests are. So I fully agree with this view. We're talking ultimately about the mathematics of evolution and not the interest that can be perceived, and it doesn't matter if humans don't understand the mathematics of it or that they don't care about it. Ultimately, they're playing out through all of their phenotype, their emotions, their decisions. They're playing out the consequences of these mathematical rules and their further consequences into the future. He says, certainly we can no longer rely on our instincts to guide us through the labyrinths of modern technological society, but there is one innate capacity we possess that, combined with one or more motivations, is capable of solving this problem. Humans are uniquely equipped with analytic intelligence, the ability to tackle novel challenges. This domain-general problem-solving capacity evolved because it allowed our ancestors to find solutions to novel threats that arose in the environments in which they lived. General intelligence is distinguished from domain-specific capacities, such as face recognition and speech, specialized mental modules for solving recurring problems in the environment in which we evolve. We are flexible strategizers par excellence. So you see what Frank Salter wants here. He wants us to say there's an abstract mathematical reality about our kin relation with the rest of the nation, and we should make, since we are such theoretical beings, Since we're capable of abstract mathematical representations of any kind, we are basically the chosen one. We are the chosen species to be the one that consciously takes these mathematical rules and start living by it. It's an interesting suggestion, morally. As a moral nihilist, I will say, yeah, it's as good as any moral framework. It's not justified. It's not true. It's not real. But it's a way you could live by, and I think it would guide you toward pretty much good conclusions in the modern world, to be self-preserving and to be preserving of the demographics of your nation. That would be a great way to live. Dawkins' organism metaphor helps convey the diffuse, distributed nature of genetic interest, but also fits the idea of a superorganism. It has been suggested by some theorists that a bee swarm or a religion constitutes an individual organism. Hamilton disagreed with this conceptualization, preferring to take the perspective of the genetically interested individual, the position I take in this volume. Genetic interest residing in a population is a collective good that belongs, as it were, to its individual members. Any reference to an ethnic group's genetic interest in this text is shortened for this meaning. So that's interesting. He's not having a theory of group selection or culture is in the air or there's this thing out there that has its own interest. He's saying ultimately the ethnic interests I'm talking about only matter to individual. It's not something out there. It's not the ethnic doesn't exist out there. The ethnic is a construct made only of individuals. So that's definitely the standpoint to take, which is why ultimately I have great respect for this book, even if I end up having my questions that are left in my mind. That's definitely the position to take, because when you read these gene culture coevolution people, or you read the mimeticist, they all end up creating evolutionary interests that are out there and rooted in nothing physical. It's like the memes are reproducing, but the memes aren't making copies of themselves. And as I show in the revolutionary phenotype, they aren't controlling their mutation. And it leads to problems. So I really like the Frank Salter physically inspired approach where the ethnic doesn't exist really other than in terms of the mathematics of the number of people. He says, to correctly interpret this equation, and he's talking about equations of differentials, equation of genetic distance. He says, to correctly interpret this equation, it is necessary to understand the relativistic nature of kinship, as explained with regard to ethnicity by Hamilton in the quote below. The kinship of two randomly chosen individuals in a population is zero. In the same context, two siblings have a kinship of 0.25, equivalent to Hamilton's relatedness R of 0.5. The relativity of kinship can be illustrated with a version of J.B.S. Alden's famous hypothetical example of altruism between kin. Alden argued that it is adaptive to give one's life to save two drowning siblings or eight drowning cousins. What he omitted to make explicit was a background assumption that these rescues occur in the context of a population of zero relatedness between random pairs. Cousins have a relatedness of 1/8, not in an absolute sense, but in comparison to the zero relatedness. Hamilton defined the kinship of two random members of a population as zero. But his own 1975 model indicated that when the variance of the metapopulation is taken into account, it is possible for high relatedness of random pairs within a subdivision. Those are very interesting specifications. It is true, and it becomes a problem when you are talking about multiple embedded systems. So you're an Englishman in the 18th century, and there's a Frenchman, and there's a Russian, and there's a North African, and there's a Sub-Saharan African, and there's an Asian. And really, the Frenchman is the one that's closest to you, but he's also the one that's most dangerous to you. If you are an Englishman and you're in a time where the English were at war with the French, you are evolving mostly to address the Frenchman threat. And you're evolving basically to ignore the threats that don't come to you, which is there's no invasion from sub-Saharan Africa of England in the 18th century. And this starts to matter when you think of how much kinship, even if you have genetic interests that are aligned with the Frenchman, the fact is you're going to have much more difficulty cooperating with the Frenchman because you're at war. And you may have different levels of interpretation where if I look at it from an inter-tribe conflict perspective, the Frenchman very dangerous. But if I look at it from a genetic perspective, the sub-Saharan African is much more distant from you. And as he eventually calculates, he ends up calculating what is the impact of 10,000 people immigrating into England. But here's the catch. Some of them are, either all of them are Danes or Danish or Danes. I think it's Danes. So he says 10,000 Danes immigrate to England, or 10,000 sub-Saharan African immigrate to England. And he's pointing out that the calculation is massively different from a genetic similarity perspective. So much so that for a single migrant, he calculates that you've not diluted your representation of your genes if he's a Dane that much. He says it's the equivalent of 1.17 babies lost if he comes into your society. But if a sub-Saharan African comes into your society, it's the equivalent of, I think he calculates, I want to get his real number because I don't want to make up stuff, but I think he calculates something crazy like 55 babies lost for the same amount of immigrants. I just want to make sure that I find this part. Okay, so there it is. At first sight, the data on inter-ethnic kinship might appear rather counterintuitive. Assuming that these figures accurately reveal overall patterns of ethnic kinship, they indicate that intra-ethnic kinship coefficients range from 0.0021, random English in relation to Danes, to 0.43, random Australian Aborigines in relation to African Mbuti in pygmy population in Central Africa. Yet one could expect that kinships between autochthonous populations within the one region to be closer than those between continentally separated populations. This seeming paradox is resolved by the realization that there is an inverse relationship between kinship within and between populations. This rule can be illustrated using the following table. Consider the two examples just mentioned. Recalled from the discussion in the previous section that if the world population were wholly English, then the kinship between random pairs would be zero. But if the world consisted of the English and Danes, then two random Englishmen would have a slightly positive kinship of 0.0021. This is slightly closer than the kinship of eight linear generations separation, or a descendant to his, her, great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparent. In other words, because English and Danes are very close genetically, there is only marginal kinship between randomly chosen English. A random Englishman would not lose many copies of his distinctive genes if another random Englishman were replaced by a Dane. Since the kinship within and between populations stand in an inverse relation, an Australian Aborigine loses many more genes if a random fellow ethnic is replaced by an African, such as a Mbuti. This is because Australian Aborigines and the Mbuti pygmies are very distant kin, according to Cavalli-Sforza data. In a world consisting of Aborigines and Mbuti, two random Aborigines or Mbuti are very close kin, almost as closely related as identical twins, with a kinship of 0.43. Such a replacement reduces the Aborigines' inclusive fitness almost as much as eliminating an identical twin or two children. So that was not yet the comparison I wanted to bring, but I'll get there. But just a comment on what we just read. So there is something arbitrary in defining what is the world I'm looking at. Because as he just showed, if you're in a world where you look at a population that is very similar to each other, English and Danes, the events of dilution caused by immigration will end up being mathematically more shocking. And the more people who come in are different, the more intense the effect on your fitness will be. But in a world where you've already assumed lots of diversity, in a world where, let's take the Australians, Aborigines, and the Central Africans, in that world, the same dilution will be less radical, because the world was already, the zero point has been defined already very high in diversity, and therefore adding further diversity leads to less dilution. This is where he applies his formula. Let us apply this formula in considering the impact on the genetic interest of a random Englishman of 10,000 ethnic Danes replacing 10,000 ethnic English. To simplify, let us assume that this is a neat replacement so that over succeeding generations, all the immigrants survive to reproduce. We also assume that the Englishman loses no genealogical kin in the process. Replacement involves two effects: the removal of 10,000 Englishmen and the introduction of 10,000 Danes, who, according to the population genetics formula we are using, have negative kinship to the English population. The removal of 10,000 Englishmen in this case reduces the genetic interest of our random Englishman by 10,000 multiplied by 0.0021, which means 21 kinship unit. The replacing Danes bring a negative kinship of the same magnitude. Subtracting the latter from the former gives a loss to the Englishman's genetic interest of 42 kinship units. But what do those units mean in human terms? We can express those units as a number of children by dividing 42 by the parent-child kinship of the English. The number of children lost due to the immigration of 10,000 Danes is therefore 167. This is a large family indeed. So here what he's doing is he's calculating in units of children lost. And it's not that you actually lose your children. Your children still exist, but they've just been diluted because you had an English population. You've taken 10,000 English people from it and you replace them by 10,000 Danes. How many, in equivalent of units of children, how many units of DNA letters similar to you have you lost in the population? The answer is 167. So by just making a small immigration policy change, 10,000 English replaced by 10,000 Danes, you've lost the equivalent in terms of similarity to the ethnic of 160, full 167 children. Now, he goes on to say, repeating the scenario with Bantu immigrants, the loss to English genetic interest of the replacement of 10,000 English by Bantu immigrants, by 10,000 Bantu immigrants, is 10,854 children. So there is a huge distinction between European genetics and African genetics, such that you only lose 167 children units in your ethnic when you replace with Danes, because they are very much similar to you. You do the same number with Africans, you lose the equivalent of 10,900 children units. He comments on these figures. It's like an order of magnitude. It's two orders of magnitude above. He says this last figure is puzzlingly high. How can the loss due to replacement exceed the number replaced? Actually, it does not, because we are counting genes, not individuals. The result only looks strange when gene counts are converted into child equivalents, though the conversion is valid. So that's a very good illustration, a very good way of calculating damage to ethnies by replacement. And it makes me realize that, yeah, when you change for ethnies that are very distant, you lose a lot in your genetic interest in the whole of the nation. So I really like what he's doing in terms of mathematics. I like his way of calculating things and presenting things to normies. And I fully agree with his conclusion that we have to care about ethnicity. However, I've already expressed, and I will say this as a conclusion for this first part of the review, and perhaps in a couple of days I'll do the other chapters, but we'll be headed toward our conclusion. As a summary for what we've seen up to now, I take issue with replacing self-care with ethnic care. And I think that ethnic care should always be seen as a secondary objective, never to replace the first objective that reproduction is. Because if you don't come with reproduction, if you merely adopt a strategy of kinship and ethnic favoring, eventually the kin around you, the nation around you, can build itself so as to exploit this generosity at your expense. And eventually you'll find yourself defending a kin that wouldn't be as much you as your children would. Because these mathematical calculations are all beautiful, but the big problem is I can easily make a world in which your self-sacrifice to the ethnic slowly is driven away from your own genetic interest. I could make a world in which, okay, well, I'm going to replace all of the Englishmen with people that look like Englishmen, but they have just one more letter of DNA away from you, and then a second more, and you'll always be stuck to find yourself closer to these Englishmen than you are to Africans, but I could drift you away. But if I was able to control the whole genetics of a society, I could easily drain the self-sacrificial effort of those race believers by making the race slowly different. And they would always, it would always be in their ethnic interest to mathematically self-sacrifice for the race. But I would slowly take their race in another direction than the one that would have happened naturally. Now, I'm not saying that this would happen in nature or in human society, but I'm saying because there is such a thing as races drifting away from any individuals, I think it's a healthy thing to keep in evolution this ability to care for yourself first, and let the race cares be an emergent process, a secondary objective that is very often aligned with your own interests, but that shouldn't be, you shouldn't abandon yourself to it. Now, I don't think Frank Salter suggests that we should abandon ourselves, but I think he suggests to be objectively taking just the mathematical calculation of our genetic interest as being the truth, the one thing to pursue. I think this mathematical calculation can lead you astray when you are considering all of the defects that it has in terms of what I talked about, in terms of relative versus absolute representation, when do I use one calculation, when do I use the other. And in terms that it's extremely influenceable by the by degrees of population that you shouldn't care about. My genetic interest in the European people changes if I double the amount of people in Africa, and that shouldn't be, you know, that shouldn't be in the sense that I should have a sense of the usefulness of my existence in Europe to myself and to my chances of perpetuating children into the future, independently of whether I mathematically double the number of people in Africa who I will never meet, who I will never see. There is something very unnatural in this mathematical per abstract framework of genetic interest distributed across non-reproducing individuals that I can't totally buy it. I can't totally buy kin selection either until it is demonstrated to me that there was enough moments where it mattered how many people were in Africa to the evolution of a man in Europe. I don't think it mattered that much. Sentient Potato sends a super chat. Thank you so much for supporting the show. He says, JF, can you please convert these dollars into units of children? Well, most people will do what? On average, $40,000 a year. They will make about 2 babies in their entire life. They will be working for, I don't know, 40 years. So 40 years multiplied by $40,000. All of this to make, so that's people will make $1.6 million in their life approximately. I mean, good workers, I guess, not everyone. So they will make 2 babies with this $1.6 million. So that means each baby is worth $800,000. So $800,000 divided by $5 that you just gave me. You just gave me, oh no, 5 divided by $800,000. You just gave me the equivalent of 0.0000625 babies. Thank you, Sentient Potato. I'll see you all tomorrow and will be, maybe not tomorrow, I'll be able to finish my review of Frank Salter. I wanted tonight to express the first thoughts that come from my head, and that those are what comes to mind when I read Frank Salter. It's a system of thought that I'm not comfortable with, although I'm happy that he's making the best case for it. And we'll be finishing our part 2 of this review maybe in a week from now or in a couple of days from now. Bye-bye and have a good night. Thank you.